Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 27, Episode 22. Coming up on this show, we've got the initiates of Department Zero, the Hall of Lost Technology, and a 1962 expedition to the Valley of Immortality. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
What an incredible story I have coming up for you today.
Yes.
It's just mind-blowing. I don't know how I managed to find this book, but it's been sitting in the back of my library. For a long time.
It's been sitting in my library for a long time as well.
And I understand.
After I tried to read it years ago.
Yes, I understand why. Because I picked up this book. We're going to be talking about Transylvanian Sunrise. And this book was actually, it's published through Peter Moon. Peter Moon has kind of put a frame around it. But
the
Peter
Montauk
Moon,
guy.
The Montauk guy, exactly. That's where we know him from. But ultimately, he ended up getting in contact with a Romanian publisher that was like, I want to put you in contact with a guy who is a former Romanian intelligence officer. And he has an incredible story to tell. And so this guy's name is Radu Cinema. Now, I don't know if these are real names. There's a lot of things in this story where it's like there's been aliases put in to hide the truth. But ultimately, once I got past some of the impenetrable writing, because it's translated from Romanian, it ends up being this rip-roaring story.
Does it?
Of allegedly this occult group that is trying to stop this secret knowledge from being spread to humanity.
I remember reading the first chapter and giving up.
Yes.
And I'm amazed that you've pulled a story out of it.
Because that's why I'm
it's
so happy
translated
about it.
From, what was it, Romanian?
Romanian, yeah.
It's all over the place. The translator does a horrible job, and whoever does the editing just throws in all their own stuff on top of it.
Well, that was Peter Moon.
Right.
So Peter Moon, as I said, has framed this. He's put his introduction in explaining, you know, how he's sitting in the back of this truck heading up this Transylvanian mountain. But ultimately, it's kind of irrelevant to the story. The real crux of the story is this alleged intelligence officer and the discovery, ultimately, of what is supposed to be the most significant archaeological find that humanity has ever come across. And it's this location inside, I think it's the Busai Mountains in Romania.
And there's some special individual that's the center of the whole thing, right? I remember reading that he had...
Caesar Brad.
He had a problem with his stomach and it was revealed he had metal intestines. That's one of the details, right?
Well, I skipped over that because that wasn't...
Oh, you skipped over that?
I skipped over that because that wasn't entirely relevant to the story.
The dude has... He's like Wolverine, but instead of cool claws, he has a metal... lower
you intestine. Have no idea just how much irrelevant information, and that would sound like it's relevant. Like you go, that's
not
amazing.
Relevant to the story.
There's like little, like incredible stories where it's like, well, I was told by another intelligence officer about this incredible recovery of this occult object, and the next thing, but I can't tell you about that because it's secret.
Oh.
And that was like littered throughout the book. So it sounds like I'm giving it a bad rap. It's actually a really fun and exciting story, which I'm going to tell you. But before I get into it, what have you got coming up later on in the show?
My story was a bit like that today as well, where there are all these little sidetracked escapades don't go anywhere, but they were still really fun. I was looking into this story of this Tibetan Lama. His name's Tulshuk Lingpa.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 1960s, this guy led hundreds of followers through treacherous, ice-ridden, glacial mountain paths to find a cracked open entrance to a Shangri-La-type heavenly realm. Not a metaphorical door.
Like it's not some...
Like an actual door into a mountain that would lead into some kind of valley that had been hidden by the gods for thousands of years. And he convinced hundreds of people that he was going to make his way inside. It's this incredible story, this real expedition from the 1960s, because, of course, Tibet was already occupied by yes. China at the time. And it had this real sense of emergency for the Tibetan people. What are we going to do? How are we going to save the Dharma? How are we going to save our culture? And what people noticed, the author Thomas Shaw, who did this work, he noticed that in the old scriptures from history, the Tibetan people had looked for this place in the past.
So there's obviously some type of history behind it, some folkloric legends to
yes,
it.
Yes, the local people in the region, the Tibetans themselves, have been talking about this. It's not Shangri-La. It's a completely different area. It's in the kingdom of Sikkim, which is now in northeastern India, but it used to be its own kingdom. It used to be an independent kingdom with a royal family. And in this region of Sikkim, there's this heavenly mountain. This was always called heavenly by the locals. And their culture has stories going back thousands of years of being contained in this mountain range, which is part of the Himalayas, this hidden valley. And you'll go there and immediately, even if it's cold, you never feel cold. There's stories of you get one grain of rice, you put it in your pot, and then you cook that grain of rice. You take the lid off and you got a full pot of rice.
Is it that stories of Shambhala? Like, yeah. Aren't there stories of Shambhala that has magical properties about it?
It's the same thing, but you go back through thousands of years of Tibetan scripture.
Yeah.
And when the Mongols were invading, you've got all these lamas going, okay, we've got to open like the heavenly gate to Sikkim. We've got to get in there and save our people. When the Muslims were invading, it's the same thing. We've got to open the heavenly gate to Sikkim and save our people. So there's this legend that's always been in the country and Tibet that when things are dire, when it looks really bad, like it's almost
it's a panic room.
It's a cataclysm. It's a panic room for the entire people of Tibet. And because the Chinese Communist Party was taking over the country and destroying everything and killing lamas, they all got together and realized this is the time to open the gate. And they basically had a vision of this checklist of who the incarnated lama would be to take them through the gate.
And he had the access code in some way.
Yeah, there's like every, 2,000 years, someone incarnates who has the access code and they can open the gate to this hidden valley. And this guy was the guy.
Do we end up doing the same story? Have we done exactly the same story? Because according to this Romanian intelligence agent, there has been a facility which is, there's a pathway. There's these like tunnels, and I'll go into these tunnels later on in this story, but essentially there are these underground tunnels. And the American military got involved, or at least, the American military backed by American intelligence agencies. And of all these tunnels, basically the Americans went, oh, well, you can have access to this tunnel and that tunnel. We don't want that. But we want just this one singular tunnel. And guess where the tunnel goes? It goes to Tibet, apparently, and then it leads down into the inner earth. So it's got this feeling of it being like some type of Shangri-La or some type of, hidden realm.
It feels like a lot of the stories, especially the modern ones, come from a source like this that yeah. you can trace back to a very ancient point in time. And like I was saying, there's all these fun offshoots. Like there's a guy they found who was one of this Tulshuk Lingpa as one of his disciples. And the great thing about Thomas Shaw, who wrote this book, he tracks down everyone who was on the expedition.
Oh, wow.
And firsthand, like speaks to the guy's son, gets all the inside info. He tracks down this disciple and who's been busy for 30 years trying to get all the ingredients for an invisibility potion.
Okay, cool.
And apparently this Lama master gave him the ingredient list and he's been trying to collect it. It's been so hard. So you need a cat afterbirth.
What?
You need poop from a black cat that's hung by a tree under a full moon. You need a raven's nest from a special tree in like somewhere in the Himalayas, but it has to be an auspicious raven's nest because when you get a twig off it, you throw it in the river, the twig needs to flow upstream. And there's another secret ingredient that he wouldn't reveal, but the reason he'd been doing it for 30 years is because he had, after about 10 years, he'd got all the ingredients and he had put them into a suitcase under his bed. And because the ingredients were all together, they made his suitcase invisible and he lost it. And he had to start again.
forgive me because I don't know the finer points of invisibility, but just because it's invisible, it doesn't mean it's no longer there.
This is so funny because he's talking to the translator and the translator's telling him that this old man, he's in his 80s and sure. He's like, oh, you have to get a string and you get the string and you tie it to your shoe. And the guy's like, the author's like, oh, hang on a second. Well, I don't understand. Why do you need a string and you got to tie a bag to your shoe? And he says, oh, when you put the ingredients in the bag disappear and then you lose it. So you got to have this bag of the ingredients constantly tight. As soon as you put that last bit of cat turd in there, like, boom, the bag just goes, boom. And when they go to this guy's house, there's like dozens of black dogs guarding the place. And he asks the old man, he's like, do you have all these black dogs to stop people from stealing your ingredients? And he says, no, the black dogs are for the shit ingredient I need to make it rain when the king asks me to make it rain. Like, he looks at him like he's an idiot. Because he's like a shaman that makes it rain as well.
Is it alchemy as well? Does it have that kind of element?
It's
just,
it's all shaman.
Yeah, right.
Like bond shaman.
All right. Oh, well, I'm looking forward to getting into that. Well, let's head into this book, Transylvanian Sunrise, which actually has a follow-up book, which is called, I think it's Transylvanian Sunset or Moonrise. I don't know. I'll put it in the show notes. Because
genius.
I'll leave it for you to go through because I have done all the hard work on this book to present this for you. I will link to this book as well. But if you want to get the follow-up story, go and check out the show notes and read it. Look, it's a really incredible read. But yeah, you do have to pay a lot of attention throughout this book because there's just so much going on. There's clearly something that has gone wrong. I shouldn't say wrong, but something that's happened with the translation where it just doesn't flow. So you got to kind of pick
Doesn't flow is being so generous.
Look, I've read a lot of Peter Moon stuff before. He's done so much work with the Montauk stuff. So I was like, oh, you know, yeah, this should
none of that's translated from Romanian.
No, and that's the issue, right? So let's start. Let's just jump into this. So it starts essentially where on August the 11th in 1999, what had been happening was that Peter Moon and Preston Nichols, they'd been running these little get-togethers, these little Montauk meetings, and they had a newspaper that they were publishing, so obviously it was picking up a lot of attention. And you know the story behind Montauk and the weird occult practices and the weird government influence and intelligence stuff that went on there. So obviously you're attracting different kinds of people that are, you know, very much interested in these sorts of topics. Well, as he's, you know, running one of these sessions, this Dr. David Anderson shows up at this monthly meeting on Long Island and goes and sits down and watches this presentation that was conducted by Peter Moon and Preston Nichols. Now, after listening to the lecture that evening, David gets up and he goes and introduces himself and he just says, oh, look, you know, I've actually been doing time travel research. I'm really interested in what was going on with Montauk because there are allegations that there was some type of time travel experiments or something akin to that that may have been involved somewhere in the Montauk story. So you can see why this Dr. David Anderson would, you know, go and gravitate towards these guys. And obviously, Peter was intrigued by him. And he said, look, we had a discussion and very quickly, it was about a week's time, David invites him to lunch. And he says, yeah, sure, I'll come and meet you for lunch. So off he goes. And David's sitting there and he's having a chat with this Dr. David Anderson. And he's very interested in Montauk research. But then he starts talking more about his background and his experience. And I guess that when you're talking about topics like Montauk, you are going to attract people that already have some pretty wild beliefs and, you know, ideas out there. But he says this Dr. David, he knew his stuff. He had a PhD in physics. He'd formerly worked for the Air Force. He'd been involved in the prestigious Air Force Flight Test Center in the Mojave Desert. He was ultimately assigned to working on some satellite program that the military was having trouble with. So the military was deploying satellites. But the problem with the satellites that they were putting up, and obviously they were very high-level, you know, secretive-style satellites. It's just not your standard run-of-the-mill satellite. These satellites would start drifting by several meters. And it doesn't seem like it's a lot, but because they were drifting, it was creating huge amounts of chaos for the military.
That would be a problem.
Yeah, well, obviously, if they were being used for, you know, geo-positioning, those sorts of things, it was throwing everything out of whack. So David was brought in to see if he could work out what was going on with this. Now, David claims, obviously, without going into the actual details of what he did, he claimed that his approach was to create a time-space module based on Einstein's theories. It was very advanced, but essentially space-time could be warped around the satellite to maintain its orbit correctly. And it worked. And Peter Moon points out that David apparently was clever enough to patent his algorithms and the technology that essentially allowed him to manipulate space-time. And he then took these patents and this knowledge and this technology. He left the military and he created the Time Travel Research Center, which was based in Long Island. And you go, oh, well, that's a bit crazy. I mean, come on, really? You're going to go take your business and you're going to call it the Time Travel Research Facility? But apparently this facility or this business did exist, and it was a contract to a military contract for obviously continuing its satellite maintenance program. So there were governments that were coming to him saying, look, we need you to maintain our satellites, and that's exactly what we do.
So somewhere there's evidence that the government contracted a company called Time Travel Research Facility.
Allegedly. Allegedly. So where it becomes a little bit more exotic, obviously, is where he says, well, look, besides satellites, David was also testing laser beams that create self-contained fields the size approximately of a soccer ball. And inside this field that was created, you could speed up or slow down time. And this was a great interest to the medical field because the people were suggesting that you could use this to transport organs, and it would somehow improve the shelf life of organs. So, you know, when you've got, you know, this terrible accident happens and someone's a donor and, you know, they've got to ship their organ to the other side of the country, to the recipient, you would put it in this weird soccer ball laser space bubble that would stop it from aging.
So you've got this new technology that can transport anything around the globe instantaneously, and immediately they go to organs. This is great for the organ industry.
Well, it's not that you can, it's not a transporter. It essentially just slows down space-time and it stops the organ from aging. Oh. So you can keep it for much longer when you're transporting it.
Oh, here's a better idea. Build a fridge. And sell it. People could put their food in there. It's a much bigger market than organs.
Well, I don't think you want your lunch right next to a liver floating there. But hey, you know.
No, like fine. You build it so that it's the size of a fridge.
But well, you could see.
You put your steak and your milk in there.
You
can
see the
about?
Application of it, though.
Yeah, that's a much real. Bigger application.
Perhaps. Regardless, though, he claimed that because obviously he was working with very high level technologies and concepts, he had to make sure that his research was never compromised or stolen. So he started compartmentalizing his research. And this is where we start to get into the story. Because I'm going, okay, this is all fascinating, but what on earth does it have to do with Romania? This is where Romania comes in. Because he compartmentalized his research and obviously his researchers, he spread out across the world. So he had three labs around the world. One was on Long Island. I can't recall what the other one was, but one center was based in Romania. And this is where, obviously, he started making his own contacts, and the Romanian military would have been, you know, knowledgeable about this. And he said to Peter, look, I want to work with you guys more. And Peter was interested in this. But abruptly, after they just finished their kind of initial stages of planning and what they were going to do, because they were going to run some, presentation or a conference, you know, talking about more of these topics. And David says, look, I'm sorry, I can't come and speak to you for the moment. I've actually just been informed by the military that I have to report to Moscow, and I have to go right now. And if I don't return...
Moscow?
Within, yeah. If
what
I don't,
is this?
I know. So if I don't return within 2 weeks, there could be problems. And he started apparently making like a lot of attention about this because he wanted people to know that he was supposed to be back in 2 weeks, which sets this scene that there was something very odd going
on. I thought this was 1999. Why would he go to Moscow?
Exactly. Well, I don't know. That's just where he said he went. He was suddenly summoned by the military to go to Moscow. And so, and clearly he didn't want to go there because he was telling people, I'm supposed to be there for 2 weeks. If I'm not back within 2 weeks, you know, you should make some noise. The guy doesn't come back after 2 weeks. And apparently Peter Moon was about to create a ruckus when he received an email from David saying, look, don't worry, I'm okay, everything's fine. Now, when David got back and ended up speaking to Peter once again, he explained what had happened in the meantime. He said once he'd returned to the Time Travel Research Center, he started having serious security problems. He'd been broken into at least twice. He'd been forced to move. There was some type of threat that was coming to his research. And funnily enough, the government assured him that they would take care of his security problems if they would make them a partner in his operations. And so he agreed. But he ended up giving up controlling interest in the Time Travel Research Center and went off again to work in private industry. And along this time, he left the Long Island facility and shut it down. So everything goes quiet for a little while. And then in April of 2003, Preston Nichols and Peter get this call. And it's coming from just Dr. David again. And he says, look, I'd like to meet up with you guys. I'd like to see you. And he's like, yeah, okay. And it's been years. Like, they haven't seen him in a while. And he comes up to them and says, look, I'm really sorry, but I'm not able to work with you at the moment. Now, I'm starting to wonder
here.
What's
the point of this meeting?
I know. And I'm like, basically, it's just telling him that they can't work. I'm like, you could have told him that on the phone, but that's fine. But there's more to it, right? Because this is where he says goodbye. And I start to, my skeptical mind with this, I'm like, well, you've just found some crackpot, you know, perhaps who is, spinning some story and he can't maintain the story. So he's, you know, kept you going. And all of a sudden now he's like, well, I have to go because I have to, I've got threats from the government and I've got security threats. But no, Peter says several months after saying goodbye to David, he gets this manuscript from Soren Hermas. Now, Soren Hermas is a Romanian publisher who had actually published his Montauk Project book in Romanian language. And he says, look, I wanted to know if you'd be interested in publishing a very special book. The book is called The Enemy Within. And it has two important mysterious features. One is that there is an anomalous area in the Busigi mountain range, or sorry if I butchered that, which is in Romania. It's not too far from the Romanian Sphinx. I wasn't aware that there was a Romanian Sphinx, but apparently there is. And in fact, I'll put a photograph of it in the show notes so you can see it for yourself. When you look at it, it essentially looks like it's pareidolia. It looks like it's right. it's like a rocky outcrop on a mountain. And the thing about it is, though, is because it does look like a sphinx, it's also close to this anomalous zone, which contains lost technology. So then you start going, well, whoever left this lost technology behind, perhaps I did put this sphinx structure in, but it's been there for so long that it's suffered from, you know, environmental damage, and it doesn't exactly look like that. The second part of this book, this mysterious book that was being offered up to him to publish in English, related to a baby that was born with an abnormally large umbilical cord.
There it is. That's what I remember.
And I was like, okay. As the baby grew up, he demonstrated remarkable abilities and was eventually selected to work as the head of a secret department in Romanian intelligence.
How long was the umbilical cord? Was it like the doctor was like a clown pulling out...
Well, you know,
pulling it out
for me, like I don't know how. Trick. I don't know how long though. I remember my son's being like, obviously, it was like
12 feet long.
No, apparently, like this is extraordinarily long, but it was 1.5 meters long. So what's that? That's like 4 feet, you know, if that. Maybe 5 feet. I'm like,
that's pretty long.
Is that long?
I think so.
Right. Okay. That's not the end of it, right? That's not why it was. Yes, it was long.
And that's the end of my segment.
And that's it. And that's the end of the book. So we'll just jump into your part now, Ben. No, see, the thing is, it wasn't about that. Apparently, though, like, his duties, like, it was to monitor this anomalous area in these mountains. And so I'm going, okay, I'm intrigued. And you can see why Peter would be intrigued as well. And it was just around this time where everything started to come together. Because Dr. David Anderson just popped up out of nowhere after years of having no contact, inviting Peter Moon to come to Romania, all expenses paid, to visit the annual conference that he was going to run. Now, Peter responds and says, yes, absolutely, I would love to come and do it. And he agreed to publish this book, The Enemy Within. So in 2003 or so, he travels over and he meets Dr. David. And ultimately, Dr. David Anderson puts him in contact with people in the intelligence community. And he finds out this story about Caesar Brad. So the book ultimately is not Peter Moon. Peter Moon is just, as I said, providing a kind of a reference for this kind of stuff. It all relates to this man, Radu Sinema. Radu Sinema was this man who wanted to publish this book and just tell his story. And it's not so much a story, it's more of a biography about Caesar Brad, alias, obviously. Caesar Brad is that baby with the long umbilical cord.
And is he the guy that ended up in Romanian intelligence?
Yes. So you've got Radu, who was connected to Romanian intelligence. He was working with Caesar Brad, and this is why he spent 5 years with this guy and learnt his incredible backstory, which is the story that I'm going to tell you. So, it's pointed out, Radu says, it's a mystery why of all people he chose me to tell the story, but I'm going to tell the story. And in spring of 1970, when Romania was under full communist swing, and it was just a typical communism. It was like, everything was for the people and everything had to be fair, but it just didn't work. The problem was it completely dehumanized people so much that because everything was so equal, you couldn't even tell the difference between a chair and a human. Like, it was a terrible circumstance to be in. And this young mother shows up at this hospital and she's giving birth to a child And she does. Like, she gives birth to this child. And when she does, this child has an extremely long umbilical cord, way in excess of usual standards. But it wasn't so much about the umbilical cord or the length of it. It was about the fact that it was next to impossible to sever.
That's right. It wasn't his lower intestine. It was the umbilical cord that was made of metal.
It seemingly was metal-like. So the doctor pulls out scissors and starts trying to cut the cord, and it's like blunting the scissors.
Yeah.
And so he pulls out...
They needed a laser.
Yeah, it's like he pulls out essentially garden shears next, and he's like trying to cut this cord, and he can't do it. And you can hear it was like scraping against metal until, staring in disbelief, he goes and gets a very sharp scalpel and manages to cut it. But this already starts to get attention to this child. And this child, the birth of this child, is reported to this specialized group within Romanian intelligence. Why? Like, why? Why would this child, born in 1970, be reported to this intelligence?
Clearly, you want to spend state resources on monitoring a child that has a metal body part.
We find out later on that these children, because as you can probably already infer, these children are special children. And when these children are born, they seem to have these sorts of attributes. Like, there's another kid that's born that doesn't have a long umbilical cord, but it's extremely wide.
Oh.
It was like 10 centimeters wide or something.
So it's a red flag. It's something they're looking out for.
It's a red flag that the doctors and nurses have been told to look for and have to report it back to this central authority. Now, they do. They report this, and a colonel, Daktu, shows up. Now, this colonel, he's a handler of the parents that have these particular types of children. And he starts making demands. He's like, this boy has to have no medical record. He's never had one. You must destroy it immediately. And the kid was totally normal. Like, apart from the fact that he couldn't cut his umbilical cord, he was totally normal. But as he started to grow, there were many attributes about this child that demonstrated that he was certainly different. Nothing essentially special, right? He wasn't
psychic or anything. I'm trying to remember if he had psychic abilities.
Oh, he did, but he didn't appear to at the start. Okay. Like, none of that was... It wasn't until he was 1 year old that these two grey-eyed tall men, both dressed up in suits, looking with extreme coldness in their eyes, knocked at the door. They're like Men in Black. Like, they're these MIBs that show up. And they instilled this sense of fear that was reported. And they told the parents that their son was now under the eye of certain relevant structures for reasons relating to, and I quote, great state interests that they're not supposed to be aware of. And their mission, the parents' mission, was to inform immediately and directly and without any recourse to a third party any strange, unusual, or odd developments in their child's behavior. So the mother... she says, okay, that's fine, you know, and they complied. Like, they were happy, the parents were happy to comply because the child seemed to be normal until the child didn't talk. Like, the child just wasn't talking. And I don't think the child actually spoke until he was about 3 years old, which isn't that all unusual, but I mean, it is odd. But there are some children that don't talk until they're much, much older. But they started reporting this, right? They reported it, and of course, the group would come in, these men in black would show up once again, and they would go and check on the child. But there was this strange event that took place when he was a little bit older that was very, very odd. He was 3 years old, and the mother had this habit of drawing these geometric circles. Like, she could draw these perfect circles, and she would doodle and she would draw these things. And one day when she drew one of these things and placed it on the wall, apparently the child suddenly became... in unison, stuck to it. It was like he was unifying with this thing. What? He was staring at this, and they could not unstick him, was the term used. They couldn't unstick him from the lure of these circles.
Was it just in a trance?
He's just in a trance. Like, he was meditating, but he was in a trance at 3 years old looking at these circles. He didn't even blink. And every time they tried to move him away from these circles, he would start screaming out loud. So obviously this is a demonstration of unusual behavior. The child was there for... I think by this point, it was over an hour or so where they went, okay, this is not normal. It ended up being 6 hours. The child hadn't eaten. The child hadn't moved.
Wow. Kids like circles.
It's just not normal. It's not normal at all.
Did she try drawing a square or a triangle?
No, nothing like that. But she contacts the colonel, and the colonel shows up. But this time when the colonel arrives, he arrives at about 6 o'clock in the morning. This is the following morning. So he's been up all night, you know.
Just staring at circles.
Just staring at circles and not moving. But there was this Asian man. There was this elderly Asian man. He had this short white beard. And he came through and he was speaking in English to the security officers. And the colonel introduced him as a scientist from China who was an expert on such matters.
That's right. I remember this guy and I remember thinking this did match up with not the timing precisely. Oh, actually, no, it was around the same time that the Chinese were doing research on all those gifted kids.
Yes.
It was the early 90s.
Well, that all becomes apparent in a moment because we start to understand as to why this secret occult organization was established. And ultimately, I should just explain it now. There was a dictator, the communist dictator at the time in 1968, was knowledgeable about the ESP research that was being conducted by the Soviets and the Americans. I don't know how he was briefed on that, but he knew about it. And as a result, he understood that he could utilize this to control the populace. He figured that if he could build his own program of this, you know, psi research, he would be able to grab gifted kids and utilize them to maintain his power and maintain his control. And that's exactly what he did. Now, as he had established this secretive group, which was known as Department Zero, they'd also made agreements with the Chinese government. And they did swaps, like they did secondments, and they swapped their staff. And this is why this Chinese guy shows up, right? This elderly Asian man. We find out later on, though, he's not Chinese. Like, he's somewhere else, which will become apparent.
What?
Yeah, he's
Malaysian.
No. He's come from somewhere else. But anyway, ultimately, this kid had been sitting there now for 24 hours.
And just staring at circles.
Yeah, just staring at circles. Not moving at all. And this old Chinese guy, or old Asian guy, says, everything is perfectly fine, but you must not disturb him. This is normal. You don't do anything. Now, the parents were very concerned, you know, deeply concerned about the behavior of their child, but they stayed with him. And the following afternoon, he finally indicated that he wanted to stand up. Now, the child did stand up. He ate, so his parents were happy. He seemingly slowly came out of this haze that he was under. And it was like he went back to normal. It's like nothing had happened at all, which was just strange. Like, it's extremely strange. Now, this guy was known as Dr. Zhen. Now, Dr. Zhen ultimately starts taking this kid, Caesar, underneath his wing and guiding him and checking on him. And there's several years of this happening where this Dr. Zhen will show up and will just check every time the child does something weird. And, you know, it was becoming weird because a child was displaying telepathy, ESP, other parapsychological attributes, which were obviously of interest to the secretive group. And of course, this is where the book becomes a little bit difficult to follow because it does jump around a lot. So we're hearing this backstory of when Caesar Brad is a child and going through these experiences to all of a sudden we're thrust forward into where Radu Cinema, who is the guy who has written this story, is meeting Caesar Brad for the first time as adults. And the way that it's set up, it's just trying to demonstrate the abilities that this Caesar Brad has. And it's kind of like a parlor trick in a way. But ultimately, Radu has agreed to meet up with this guy. And he's sitting in this car and there's rain pouring and he's waiting. And all of a sudden, the car door opens and skipping all formality, this Caesar Brad guy, who is now an adult, jumps into the car, says nothing, and the driver just starts driving the car. But they just start driving off. Radu has no idea what's going on. He was told to come to this location, meet this guy and wait for him. And he starts telling him about telepathy. And he's like, well, you know, do you know about telepathy? And Radu says, well, I have a small understanding of it. And he's like, well, all you essentially have to do is you concentrate a thought. It will resemble a perfectly focused beam of light like a laser. And you just blast it into the back of someone's head.
Like
pretty much like he
driver.
Had just done with the driver. Right. And that was the demonstration of this, is right. That, yes, he had essentially put this information into the driver saying where you have to go.
And the driver just thought it was him vocalizing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then, of course, he explains to him that there are occult organizations that operate at global levels that have stealthily cast their net to include Romania, and this special anomalous zone in the mountains is of vital importance, and I want you to tell this story. And this is years later. This is in 2003 that this discovery was made. But there's all these, you know, strange things that are occurring with this that come from like political intrigue and the Americans fighting the Romanians and the Chinese wanting to get in. And then there's these hidden occult groups, but there's one powerful occult group that's trying to control everything. But more on that in a moment. And this is where the book skips back to Caesar Brad and his experiences as a child. And look, I won't go into it in too great a detail. There's a whole heap of moments where things like he's a child and he's at school. And when he's at school, he's told to memorize a poem and he doesn't do it, right? And his teacher gets really mad. And she says to him, you have to memorize this poem. He's like, I've already done it. And she says, you haven't even read it. And it's in a book on her desk. And he's like, oh, blah, 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 blah. And he repeats the poem. She's like, how did you know that? And he's like, I read it from your mind. Again, demonstrating.
Cheater.
Demonstrating more of these abilities. This is when he was in grade 3. It was, you know, repeated. Then there was this horrible scene where his aunt comes to visit. And when his aunt comes to visit, he gets all upset. Like he's all anxious and all troubled. And everyone says, what's wrong? And he's like, I'm worried about my aunt. And she goes and gives him a little cuddle. And she says, what are you worried about? He says, oh, you're not going back to Bucharest, you know, in a car, are you? And she says, no, I'm taking the train. And apparently he calms down. But the following day, the news came that before going to the railway station, apparently a neighbor had shown up and said, hey, I can give you a lift back to Bucharest. And she got into the car. Sadly, she was involved in a car accident and she died. So somehow he had known that this was going to happen. And he thought because she was catching the train that it had right. kind of been done. So demonstrating this kid does have abilities. But where he was finally separated from his family was in 1980. And I think this demonstrates that there's like a genetic attribute going on here as well. There's something with his mother, because with his mother in drawing those, it never dives into it, but drawing those circles, there was more to it, which is never revealed. It's quite frustrating. Like she was doing something.
Well, obviously she's inspired by something to draw these weird circles all the time.
Yeah, but there's this scene that happens where he's a little bit older and he's lying on his bed and he's sitting in his favorite position. And apparently he had quite commonly fallen into deep meditations. It's something that he enjoyed to do. And on this particular day, he was meditating and lying on his bed, but he no longer perceived the limits of his physical body. It was like this sublime, wonderful feeling where he just kind of was blasted from his body. And as he opens his eyes, he realizes in this very typical kind of fashion of what we hear about people experiencing spontaneous out-of-body experiences, that he's floating about half a meter above his body. And his legs are still crossed, but his arms are kind of hanging down beside him. And it's like he's still kind of like his form is being sucked from his body. It's like he's still connected to it, but he's kind of floating up above. And right as he's floating up above his body, he's like, oh, this is really cool. I mean, his mother opens the door to ask if he wants to go to lunch. And almost like she'd caught him masturbating. She's like, ah, and slams the door. She saw it. She saw him out of body. Now, if he was just having an out of body experience.
Yeah, why would she see him?
She shouldn't be able to see it, but she saw it. And the fear of what happened caused him to plunge back into his body. And when he fell back into his body, he said he felt this sensation of nausea and pain in his neck as well. And his mother clearly had been unprepared, but seemingly knowledgeable about what had just taken place. Now, what does she do? She calls the colonel. And she calls the colonel. They come along and they say, you're ready. You need to come with us. And they do. They take him. They take him to this facility. He was given instructions that he had to go to a facility that was managed by Department Zero. Now, at this point in the story, as I'm listening, if you're familiar with the 90s television show, The Pretender with Michael T. Weiss, it's pretty much identical to that.
I don't know the story.
With the Pretender, it's basically a clandestine group that abducts special, well, not really abducts, but they take special kids away from their parents and then train them up and hone in their abilities for their own means and for their own purposes. That's exactly what is occurring with this. He's taken to this facility. And when he's there, he finds that there's already four other subjects there. There's three other children and this adult. Now, we don't find out any information about the adult or one of the children. But we do get information about two of the children.
They're basically making super soldiers.
They're kind of making super soldiers, yeah.
Right.
They're focusing on these super abilities to, and it's all based on the fact that this terrible communist dictator wants to keep himself in power, and he's doing it by
exploiting
children. What's
his name again? Nikolai.
Oh, I wrote it down. It's something like that. I didn't even bother to pronounce it. You can read it in the book for yourself. Where is it? I got it here.
Nikolai Chaushescu.
Chaushescu. Yeah, whatever. You know, that's not important. I think he's dead now, so that's the important part. So as he's taken to this facility, he meets this Colonel Obeda. Now, this Colonel Obeda takes him under his wing. Like, this Colonel Obeda, it's almost like, and it's so typical in these kind of things as well. It's like, I feel like it's not specifically said, but just from making it very short after reading this very convoluted story, this Colonel Obeda understands that there's something more important going on here. There's this message for humanity, or there's, you know, lost knowledge that must be given to all humanity. And so he takes this kid underneath his wing and starts guiding him. And these two kids that we find out about this facility, one of the children is a boy by, he's 14 years of age. And the reason why he was selected was by the sheer width of his umbilical cord. That was the kid with the 10 centimeters in diameter, right?
What an umbilical cord.
What an umbilical cord, exactly. So this kid was named Edward. And the reason why he was brought in is because he didn't actually seem to, it was cold, right? And he was just wearing this thin pair of cotton trousers. He had this psychic radiance that was so strong that it actually heated the air around him. Like, he had this heat coming through him. And whenever people got close to him, they'd be gripped by this feeling of fear and it would be overwhelming. And when he was relaxed, the sensations would be very low. But apparently when he got angry, small sparks, like flashes of light, were visible all around his body and particularly around his head. Objects in the immediate surroundings would break or get distorted and warped. And this is why everything that he had in his room was wooden, so that it couldn't be warped and destroyed. He had some plastic things, but it was easier to replace these things than anything else. His accommodation was connected to very special air conditioning because he couldn't handle normal temperatures. And ultimately, his main telekinetic power was that he was able to move objects with his mind. Like, this is why he was there. And
Professor X.
Yeah, exactly. And there was this one thing where apparently he had demonstrated that he lifted a water sphere. Like, he just looked at a bottle of water, or a body of water, and then pulled out a water sphere out of it and then moved it all around the room, demonstrating these parlor trick style, you know, psi abilities. So that's why one was there. The other kid was called Octavian. Octavian was the same age, or roughly the same age, as Caesar, and he didn't seem to stand out as having any particularly special gifts, apart from the fact that he had this exceptional ability to foresee the future, but only within a range of 10 to 20 hours, right?
This is just Romanian X-Men, you realize.
Yeah, right. Well, as I'm reading this, I'm like, this sounds like that 7 days show as well. I don't know. But
if you search YouTube, you'll probably find a Romanian X-Men video. Because there's a Russian version as well.
And oh, is there?
It's just all these weird homeless people with powers.
Like, right.
The narrator says, Professor X, and it's like a drunk guy in a wheelchair. And then he says, Cyclop, and it's a guy it's a guy with one eye, drunk, doing something. Gambits this homeless person with cards. I'll find it for the show notes.
Yeah, we'll chuck it in. That'll be great. No, I think it's a little bit more probably sophisticated than that.
Right.
But with this Octavia kid, the reason why he was in this facility is because they would use him to predict the future. And ultimately, when they were training him, they got his performance. His performance gradually improved to the point where he could see 28 hours into the future.
Wow.
But look, when you think about it, 28 hours into the future is pretty good. Well, that gives you enough time to buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah, first thing you do, you go to an important sports game, check the winner,
place your
bets, you're rich.
So, you know, then the book goes through describing how these kids, you know, seemingly have these abilities and, you know, yada, yada, yada. It's all in the book. I won't go into it in great detail. But ultimately, when Caesar was at this facility, it was called Base B, he made remarkable progress. He developed, you know, superior perception skills. His abilities really became quite extensive. And this mysterious Dr. Zien would show up and would communicate with him. And again, you know, this poor kid had been taken away from his parents, at least had the support of these people. Like, there was the colonel and there was this doctor that took him under their wing. And in 1986, there was this turning point in Caesar's life where it was essentially what was described as an extraordinary spiritual experience. But I don't know if it's really, I guess you have to be there, right? But the reason why it came about is because he somehow knew that his father had died in a car accident, or in a stupid accident, he said, 2 years before. And his mother was in a bad way. And at this point through the story, or through being told by Caesar, he's asked, well, how did you know that? And Caesar just simply responds to Radu and says, well, look, I can tell you that while my physical body may have been restricted in its movement, I had great freedom, implying that he was leaving his body and going out with his abilities. And Essentially, as he was doing this, though, he says there's a couple of things he started to realize. He said around the world or in these spaces that he would go to, there were treasures or special secret storehouses that had gates. Some of them had galleries and there were quick access pathways where you could get into these places, but astral obstacles would be placed in these locations.
Holy crap.
He said there were like restricted access to these certain occult locations, and there were even threshold guardians. The term threshold guardians isn't used. He says that they were summoned guardian entities, but he's essentially describing threshold guardians. So he was restricted in going into these places. Which starts to, you start to get the idea of, well, then what's going on in this anomalous zone in the mountains?
It's funny that you mentioned that because Tulshuk Lingpa, the master from the story I'm going to be describing in the Plus extension, says exactly the same thing.
Really?
And he's one of the, I can't remember the term because I don't have it in front of me now, but there's a term in Tibetan that translates loosely to treasure hunter. But the treasures that they're describing are... they're not like jewels or gold.
No, it's like knowledge.
It's knowledge treasure.
Yes.
And
yep.
There is guardians. There's always a spirit guardian there to stop the average person from finding it.
Oh.
And only one of these particular Tibetan treasure hunters has the key to unlock it.
Well, he was encountering them.
So it's like he's one of those guys.
He's encountering them. So as he's experiencing these things, ultimately the colonel says to him, look, I'm going to take you to Bucharest. I need to take you to a monastery. And Caesar says, oh, why? He's like, look, I want you to meet someone very important. He's a clergyman who is very special. He's known as the hermit Arsene Boka. And he says, oh, okay. Now he's taken away. Look, again, it's communist rule. You certainly don't want to be going to a monastery or hanging around religious locations. So it's kind of said, this colonel's like, oh, I'm taking Caesar out because he needs to see his mother because his mother's, you know, hasn't quite gotten over the accident with the father. Never takes him anywhere near that. Takes him to this hermit, like to this priest. Now, this hermit apparently died 3 years later in 1989, shortly before the revolution, because the revolution happened, you know, in 1989. But when he had this spiritual experience, essentially, Boka told him this incredible secret where he was the only person to retain it after this Boka had died. So the story is, and again, this is part of the convoluted nature of this book and this story. I'm trying to understand, but he's taken to this monastery, which is guarded and protected, and it's all very hush-hush and very secretive. And it's like, oh, you know, we're worried about the communist regime and people going to dob people in. And ultimately, what really happens is that this priest gives him this knowledge. And this knowledge is that one day he's going to have to fight this incredible battle, that there is going to be an amazing find which will have ramifications for the entirety of humanity, and it is going to be his responsibility to understand this and bring this knowledge to the rest of humanity. But the problem is he's up against a very ancient evil force, this occult group, this very powerful occult group that is like an octopus. It has its tentacles in institutions all around the world. It's not just communism, it's everywhere, it's all through the US. And Caesar is going to have to battle this. He's going to have to face this. Now, Caesar and Obeida leave this colonel and they go back to the facility, and Caesar is quite in shock about this because he's like, well, what am I going to have to do? And it turns out that, you know, a number of years later, I think it was like 17 years later, there is this finding. There's this finding of this strange cavern in the anomalous zone that has been the focus of this book. And the information contained within is something that Caesar has to get access to and bring to the rest of the world. But the way that it's discovered is very unusual, and it brings to the surface this occult group that is trying to stop this knowledge from being spread out. So Caesar follows these years through. He does intense training and he prepares to take over. He doesn't know this, but he ultimately prepares to take over as the director of Department Zero when he grows up, right? And he does. Like, he's told that, would you like to take control and be the director by Obeida? And he says, yes, yeah, I'll do that. He agrees to it. And ultimately, his role is that he has to monitor for code red situations that happen throughout, and type K, they're called type K situations that happen throughout Romania. I was like, okay, well, I'm intrigued by this. So apparently, to give you an example of what type K situations are, this Department Zero really is a Men in Black group. They are designed to go in to isolate locations where strange anomalous activity takes place, essentially get the public to pretend like nothing happened, to suppress witnesses and to stop information from getting out. And in 1981, something very odd happened in the Carpathian mountain range. This is one of the highest Type K events that was taken care of by Department Zero. There were two brother mountaineers that were doing some training. They were climbing a high and rather isolated rock, and its walls were very steep that formed a cavity of sorts, with the upper end being the real challenge to the mountaineers. Now, one of the brothers climbed up three quarters of the rock, according to the story, according to this file, and they found some strange, bizarre signs carved into the stone. They'd been eroded by the passage of time, but they could definitely see them. Now, one of them came to this narrow platform that was within the rock, and he bent down and picked up this strange yellow object. When he picked up the object, he suddenly dematerialized.
What?
Leaving his brother dumbfounded, looking at the face, you know, from the base of this
rock.
Was
there like a little wet puddle?
No, nothing like that's described. He just was gone.
He's just vanished. Just
gone. Now, the brother went running back to the town, and people didn't believe him. They made fun of him. And he's like, no, my brother, he just disappeared. Like, you know, he's my friend. He's gone.
Was
like,
the thing he picked up still there?
No, that's not described either. But the father, the brother's father, he was an ex-mountaineer himself. Like, he knew. He's like, there's something weird going on. He climbs the rock. Oh, you're right. Here you go. He picked up the object and disappeared instantaneously too. But this time before the eyes of tens or dozens of witnesses.
Did they all touch the weird rock thing?
No, but obviously the knowledge got out.
Would you touch it?
No, like, it's no, of course not. Where are you going?
What if you're being transported to some magical place of the mole people?
After the way you describe, what is it with your weird obsession with mole people?
What if
sexy
you get
mole people
transported to a mole woman harem?
No, I'm fine. I'm good, thanks. The military team was deployed by Department Zero. The military team, they closed off and apparently isolated the region for 100 meters around, like this whole rock, and everything was shut down. Now, ultimately, they dynamited the rock. They just blew it all up. And
if one of the fragments hit you, would you dematerialize?
No, well, that's not said either. But apparently, even 20 years after the incident, the area is now completely clean. The missing people have never come back. And interestingly enough, after the rock was dynamited, the people could see, they didn't report it, obviously, the information came out later on, but they reported that they could see this translucent kind of green glowing steam that was around this area after it had been blown up, and that was it. Now, this is the other thing. I'll give you this note about the story. This is said over and over throughout. It's so frustrating. Caesar then told me about two other amazing cases, but asked that I not mention them in the book.
Okay. Great.
Great. Great. So 1990 came around, and as I said, he takes over role as director, being given to him by Colonel Obeda. And Caesar says to the writer of this biography that, look, I want to make this story public, and this is why I'm telling it to you. This is why I'm giving you a detailed account, because it's crucial for the destiny of this country and the knowledge of mankind.
So this young man is now the head of the most secretive intelligence organization in Romania, which yes.
is a men in
technically
black group.
Still part of the Soviet Union?
I don't know. Because there's been a revolution that took place in 1989. So we get to 1990 where he takes over. Now, in May of 2002, he was at another base. This was called Alpha.
You know, we don't, Alpha Base.
Alpha Base, right? And as he's there, he's told that apparently a very important member of an intelligence agency is coming to see him, and he has to meet with them. And he says, oh, okay, that's... He's like, no, you have to go now. Like, we have to... And this helicopter arrives.
Is it the Asian guy from earlier?
No. What steps off this helicopter is this very tall and sober-looking gentleman in this dark black suit, but he's just giving off this air of negativity and evil. His name's Signor Massani. Now, Signor Massani, he essentially... The book goes into this, like, chapters and chapters of this Signor Massini.
His whole life story.
Telling him about, he's like all paranoid, like he's all kind of, yes, but he's paranoid. And he comes from this high up group that's in Italy. Turns out that this is this occult group that's trying to control the world. And he says, look, they try to take Massini into this room. And he's like, no, I can't talk to you in this room. There's bugs, there's radio equipment. And of course, Caesar Brad says, no, this is a secretive facility. You can't nothing will happen. He's like, I don't believe you. And so they set up a table outside. It's all got very Alice in Wonderland feelings about it because they set up a table out in a field and they've got a circle of men around them that they're far enough away that they can't hear. And then this guy knows that there's no bugs listening. And ultimately, he gives him an ultimatum. He says, you join our group or I'll destroy Department Zero. And he's like, apparently Caesar Brad, because there's this feeling of like he's kind of got this...
I'll never join you, weird Italian man.
Well, he comes up with this idea that basically what he can do is that if he refuses, his career in Department Zero and everything he's worked for and the loss of his family is going to be worth nothing. It's going to be all destroyed. But what he will do is he will join them and then destroy them from the inside out. So he agrees, right? And for whatever reason, this high-ranking member of this secretive ancient occult group just trusts the guy. It's like, yes, I know I can trust you. And he does. And he starts telling him. And this is where I said it goes on for chapters and chapters of like, oh, well, this is what this group does. And they're involved with the Bilderberg group and they're controlling the banking system. And we destroy people that
what are they
come
called?
Against us. It's the Freemasons.
Oh, it's just the bloody Freemasons.
And it's like,
oh, my God.
It's like, no, but it's not the Freemasons. Like, anyone can say Freemasons, and it has a certain connotation, but this is the real secretive, dark group of the Freemasons that are controlling the world. And I'm like, yeah, okay, look, that's not really important to the story. And that's where I must say, I mean, as fascinating the story has been until this point, I did have a fleeting moment of just being like, oh, I don't know if I can do this book, because it went on and on and on, and I'm like, I can't. Fortunately, though, as I move forward through the book, I find that there's the reason why this Signor Masani shows up. It's because, obviously, being an advanced occult group, they've got a lot of contacts, their fingers are in lots of pies, they've got people that are at the Pentagon. Now, he claims that they've received ultra-secret data from the Pentagon, that they have discovered something of extreme importance and has been brought to the attention of the world's elite, because it relates to a secret cave that was discovered in Romanian territory. And of course, the military, like a secret military operation, has pumped huge amounts of money into geodesic espionage programs, you know, yada, yada, yada. Long story short, in 2002, one of these very specialist secretive satellites that has this bionic and waveform technology, allegedly, on board, detected an energy signature. This energy signature was from within a mountainous area in Romania, focusing precisely on the region that we've been talking about. Specialists analyzed this data, and the reason why it came to the attention of the elites is because it happens to turn out that the energy signature that was found inside the Romanian mountains matched an energy signature that was found in Baghdad only a couple of years before.
Ooh.
Implying that there was something in Baghdad that had been discovered, and that's the whole purpose of the war, the invasion, the war on terrorism,
to
the invasion
the
of Iraq, was to uncover some stargate. I mean, some people have said it's something else. And it seems to be access to one of these places. But this energy signature was important because the people at the Pentagon couldn't understand some of the functions of this facility. There were, and apparently this... Freemason produces a document and a technical diagram of what had been found, a computer diagram of what had been found. And there were these blocked zones. There was no entrance, like there was no connection to the exterior, but there was this massive form on the inside with these entrances, but these entrances stopped abruptly and they had these blocked zones. And Caesar starts looking at it and he's like, are these force fields? And he's like, yes, artificially projected energy blockages. And he's like, oh, okay. He's like, and that's why we need you. You're special. And so that's why they came to this guy. Caesar seems to have some type of special ability, which isn't apparent until much later in the story.
And he can break through the force fields.
You got it. Yeah, you got it. But we don't know that yet, right? And that's not explained to him. But it's essentially told to him that obviously you being part of Department Zero, you're the one who was the director of this, you're on top of this, you need to get a team out to this location and you need to get in. The problem is, even though we're Freemasons and we've got a lot of control, we still have to work with the Americans because the Americans have the plasma technology we need to be able to get through into that space. He says, oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, well, that's fine. He finds himself on this Department Zero helicopter. And he goes into the mountains. This is Caesar. Caesar comes out into the mountains and he finds that all this facility has been set up on the outside of the mountains where they've got all the drilling equipment. And there's this plasma cutting, tunneling and boring device which is placed there. And this tunneling boring device is being pushed all the way through. And they do. And he starts walking through this tunnel. And as Caesar walks through this tunnel, he can, and also with this, later on, the way that this is written, it's kind of like it's describing that that Radu had been taken there. And Caesar is kind of like showing him around and giving him a flashback of what had happened. So I'm going to tell it to you from the perspective of what Caesar describes. But they go through this tunnel, and this plasma cutting thing that the Americans had, the American military had, it left, what do you think, these very polished walls that we hear of in these stories of underground tunnels. It doesn't produce any dust. It doesn't produce any rubble. It just turns it into this stream of plasma at the back, and it all disappears. And the problem was is that the machine stopped when it hit these barriers, like it hit these energy barriers that were there, and it couldn't get through it. But they can see on the other side this huge gliding door, and it has some type of mechanism in it that they don't know how it works. Like, it's almost like I was thinking about Coral Castle, and there was that story of Coral Castle down in Florida having that door that pivots, like this massive, heavy coral stone door that just pivots on this very, very small axis, which doesn't work anymore. But it was like it had been put there through some advanced kind of technique. It feels like that. Like, there's this massive piece of stone that shouldn't be able to just freely glide across this platform, and it does. But they can't get to it because there's this energy entrance that's there.
I've got a story coming up of this monastery in Tibet, and it's on the cliff face. It's right next to this cliff face. And on the cliff face is a perfect rectangle area that's about the size of a door. And for some reason, the rock there is white.
Oh.
And no one can tell why. People have looked at it, geologists have looked at it, and they can't quite tell what actually makes the rock this different texture and colour. But when you look at it, it looks like a door. And inside the where a handle would be, there's a circular opening. And inside that is another stone. Now, you can actually put your hand inside this opening and grab the stone that's in there, but you can't pull it out of the opening.
But you can manipulate it, obviously.
But you can move it around. So the legends are it's an actual doorway into the mountain, into one of these valleys, into one of these areas.
Yeah.
But the hole in the rock is some kind of key mechanism, and someone needs to be able to open it.
You know, there's a story like that from the Andes, I believe. There was a story, I'll have to look it up, but there was a story of there being like this hole in a wall, but it's just like a piece of stone that's been cut away. But there seems to be like a geometric form in it. And the folklore behind it is that there was like a golden disc that was given by the gods to the locals, and that if you place this disc into this geometric structure, it will open this door. But the door is like a gateway. It's like an energy gateway. And this is in the scene where essentially Caesar starts talking to Radu about what had happened. And he said, look, when we got to this energy barrier, unfortunately, there was a very tragic accident. So three soldiers had been there. And these three soldiers had tried to force their way through the energy barrier, and essentially they were all turned to dust.
Great.
All wiped, you know, all gone.
Not just dematerialized, but there was
they
dust.
They were dusted, and they literally were, like, just completely just destroyed. And so as Caesar's, you know, this is obviously very terrible, but Caesar's there, and he starts throwing objects at this barrier. It's like, as he's throwing stuff. But he says there's a key. There's a key behind the energy barrier. It was like that. And what you just described, Ben, is that there appeared to be like a cutout of stone. And in that stone was like kind of like a triangle that was there and was all polished. It was all polished in comparison to the rest of the rock. And he thought, Caesar, is if I can get past this energy barrier, I can go and I can just manipulate this key and that will open the door. And that's exactly what happened. And Radu says to him, as they're, you know, relaying, as Caesar's relaying the story of what happened, he's like, it was an energy frequency problem, wasn't it? And he says, yes, yeah, amazed. Like, Caesar's amazed. He says, exactly. He's confirming what happened. Now, this is where, obviously, all these years of training allowed him. He said that he kind of, like, I don't know if he adjusted his vibrational frequency or whatever it was, but he focused on the energy. He could kind of see the energy of the barrier and he stepped into it. And when he stepped into it, it was only about 10 centimeters thick or even less. And he steps through the barrier. He passes through it, because he has the right matching frequency that he was able to go through it. And he said it was this amorphous kind of substance that he traveled through. And he went. Now, when they go in, he turns off this energy barrier, right? So the energy barrier is turned off and more people can come in. Now, we skip forward to the scene where he's bringing Radu in. And they walk into this hall. And as they come into the hall, they come into this dome-shaped kind of area. And it's huge. It's like 100 meters in length. And I think it's 30 meters high. But there's this kind of weird like entrance, like a sphere. There's this sphere shield which is covering over this area. And it's vibrating. And it's emitting sparks and lights. And, you know, Radu is describing what he's seeing. And he says the way that this place is built, it's like everything looks synthetic, but it feels like there's something organic about it. It's the color of petrol, so it's like iridescent. It's this dark blue, but you've got pinks and greens and colors through it that are kind of shiny. And it's a spectacular, like it's a spectacular scene. And he says, we can't stuff in here. We can't break it. We can't breach it. We can't scratch it. We can't cut it. We've tried to use fire on it. It just absorbs the heat. Fire won't burn anything. We can't get through. But he says, I want to show you this place inside the sphere. We call it the projection hall. Now, when they get into this structure, it's essentially this force field that's working. It's another force field. And I do find it funny that throughout this, you know, you've got Peter Moon, who worked with Preston Nichols. And if you recall, if you've been listening to Mysterious Universe for a while, Preston Nichols thought at one point that he could create force field technology.
He's very into force fields.
And when he was outside, he literally was like the Three Stooges going, see the force field, force field. There's a lot of force fields in this book. But they're in this kind of space. And there's this scene that happens right though, that they turn off the energy field. So Radu and Caesar go inside this space, the projection hall. And there's all these tables. It appears to be a very ancient, but at the same time, very significantly advanced room. And there's these T-shaped tables that are all around. And they all seem to have types of instruments on them. And he said, on the outside, this energy shield seemed to have this splendid, radiant blue that kind of had intense flashes of bright white light. But once you got inside, it was like this soft golden glow that was all very calming. And it kind of gave this very relaxing kind of feeling. And he says there's symbols and characters that are inscribed into the stone and these objects. He said they were clearly for scientific use, but they had several translucent wires that were coming off them, and they gathered in rectangular boxes that were underneath the table. And then the boxes were made of shiny metal, but the metal couldn't be scratched, and they were anchored to the ground. And even though the cables were delicate, you know, they seemed to be indestructible. Like a very, very advanced technology that was here. Now, he says he walks over to this table and he puts his hand onto this metal plate, or this glass plate, I'm sorry. And when he puts his hand on it, all of a sudden it throws up this holographic image in front of him, and it's his body. Like, and he can see inside his body, and his body is spinning around. So
like
it's
an
like,
X-ray machine.
Yeah, it is. What he does, using his finger on this glass plate, you can kind of navigate. And so he starts navigating with his finger.
What's a touchpad?
Moving through his body until he goes in, he's projected into his internal organs.
Ugh.
And he finds himself in a liver cell. And he's in the cell and he can see everything. He says he starts by passing over the individual cells, then he moves into one, then he can see the nucleus, and then he starts going even more subatomic where he reaches the molecular level. And he says ultimately he sees that even though he's inside his liver, he can see in the nucleus and then down into the molecular level, he can see the atom with this vague energy mist around the outside. You know what that vague energy mist is? It's the electron cloud.
Oh, weird.
It's the electron cloud of an atom that's there. And he can see this with this machine. Now, he pulls his hand away from the glass and immediately the software shuts down, or the hologram shuts down.
So it's an ancient healing machine.
Yeah, it's like there's more to it, though, because there's multitudes of all these technologies of which he doesn't know what they are, what they do, how to control them. But Caesar's job as part of Department Zero is to document these and understand them. But standing in the middle of the room is this very tall, it's like 2.5 meter tall platform. Now they walk over to it and it's got this device that looks like a shielded circular cabin that's made from transparent material. And they realize that for a person to sit inside this and then connect to the cylinder in kind of like this helmet fashion, the person has to be 3.5 meters high.
Oh.
And that's where they realize that all the objects and all the items and everything, it's all for someone who would be at least 3 meters tall.
It's the cave of the giants.
It's these giants.
Their ancient technology.
And how often have we heard stories of these giants, you know, giant skeletons being found, and the Native American stories and the old Greek story of these things? Like, they're around, right? This might be, and they determine, like, it's claimed by Caesar that they determine that this particular facility in this mountain is 50 to 55,000 years old. Like, it hasn't, the energy systems haven't been breached for 55,000 years.
And it's still got power.
It's still got power, right? And where that's coming from, we don't know. And he sees a control panel and they're looking and trying to understand what it is. There's also like this big red button that he's told not to touch, which is like brilliant because he doesn't touch the big red button. But Caesar says to Radu, he's like, I'll just touch some other buttons. And he does. And it shows this scene essentially of this catastrophe taking place and the entire region being wiped out by a massive flood. And it's kind of like a demonstration of the power of the technology that they have. Mm. But, you know, essentially Radu says, they've left us instructions, haven't they? And Caesar says, yes, that's exactly what it is. It's, they teach in very practical sense and everything is there.
So there's a video tutorial on how to use all the ancient giant technology.
Yeah, all the very convenient weapons of mass destruction.
Very convenient that they would leave that there.
So here's the next frustration, though, I have with the story, because it skips forward, like all this incredible stuff that's being seen and these technologies. And he says he's shown like this scene, this holographic image. And from it, and I quote, I clearly realize the mistake of Darwin's theory of evolution, its fundamental error. I was, you know, able to see and understand the precise elements of what had happened on Earth long ago. You know, he goes on to say that he understood why things are the way they are, the true details of man's history. But then he says, unfortunately, I was not allowed to write this in the book because certain aspects pertain to national security. Or along those lines.
What a cop-out.
You know,
it's probably just giants having sex with dinosaurs.
Something like that. Basically, it comes down to, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but ultimately it comes down to this weird mutual agreement between Romania and the United States. I'm like, what is this?
What is he talking about?
What is this, right? So as Caesar was down there and they were looking at all this technology, they were suddenly whisked to the surface. Like, he was summoned back to the surface.
Is the Illuminati grandpa there?
No, the Illuminati grandpa isn't there, but it's the military, right? And what had happened was, is that the Pentagon had been tipped off again that they'd gone in here. And the American presidency, which would have been Bush at the time, I believe, wanted a piece of the pie. Mm. And you know why they knew? Because apparently when they turned the force fields off in this particular mountain, they all turned on in Baghdad, in the facility in Baghdad, which was under the control of the Americans.
Why would that happen?
Because they're connected to each other.
Yeah, but why would, like, if I turn off my lights in my kitchen, my lights in my garage, like, don't come on? That, like, doesn't make any sense.
It's like one of the temples in Zelda. It's like you press one button, it turns off on one side and the other one turns on. That's what I'm imagining, right? That's what happened. And so, long story short, the Romanians strike this deal with the Americans to I don't know, share the technology, share the knowledge. And ironically enough, this was in 2003, Romania joined NATO in 2004.
Oh.
And apparently that was quite surprising and no one knows exactly where that kind of came from.
That's why.
That's why, because of this technology. But it was more than this, right? It wasn't just the technology. It wasn't the holographic projections. I'll put a diagram, I'm sorry, of this in the show notes as well that you can see. There's essentially this central platform, but there's three tunnels. There's three tunnels that are there. And he said, look, I'm not allowed to disclose aspects of these, really. Again, you know, like, oh, here's something incredible, but I can't tell you. But he says essentially, these three tunnels, one leads to Egypt, to a location in the Giza Plateau located somewhere between the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid. Another one leads towards ultimately Iraq and close to the Baghdad facility. Mm-hmm. That. The third one leads to a place which is in the middle of, well, it's in the middle of the room, but it's also in a place that's like the interior of the Earth. This is the one that only the Americans are allowed to go into, and they negotiated to get access to this. Like, this has got like a weird Shambhala shaver kind of
so
feel about it.
Only
this.
The Americans have access to the hot mole women.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. So this is where the story abruptly ends, right? So he was told, Radu, he finally meets up with Caesar once again. And Caesar says, look, at the end of September 2003, we're making preparations to go through these tunnels. And I will tell you what happened. Nothing. Like, that's it, right? That's the abrupt
end. That's the end of the story?
That's the abrupt end. But fortunately, there was an epilogue. that comes about from this. Now, I will link to the book in the show notes so you can actually read it all for yourself. Skip forward.
Oh, I can't
to the
wait,
epilogue.
Dude. I can't wait.
Let me just give you a few spoilers. Okay, one. We find out that the mysterious...
Tell us everything that happens so we don't have to read it, please.
The mysterious Dr. Zhen is actually not from China. He is a Tibetan monk.
Oh, my gosh.
That had been essentially, like, put in to monitor. He was this mysterious Tibetan monk by the name of Repa Sundui. And his job was to protect this space and this knowledge. Now, I don't know why. I don't know how this comes about. It doesn't really give us much other information. One thing we do find out, though, there's this outlying story where Repa Sundu apparently shows up at some Transylvanian location in the Carpathians, and he brings along with him this being, like this Tibetan kind of being with him. And when he's there, he takes a group of people through some narrow wall opening. Like he walks them through the wall.
Yeah.
And when they walk through the wall, they meet this ancient goddess called Mekanali. And so with this ancient goddess, right, she hands over this manuscript of initiation. And they're all kind of shocked. And this is where, again, like it comes back to, like, we come full circle to what happened with Montauk and all these. I don't know, but with Montauk, a lot of young boys were abducted. Because ultimately, with the second part of this, right, is that a group of mysterious adolescents arrive following the call of their dreams, wherein this, you know, this goddess had told them of where they should meet Radu. And Radu and the Repa Sundi are then initiated by the adolescents.
What?
Yeah, and I'm like...
initiated by children?
Yeah, well, adolescents. So I'm like, what is going on? The point is, though, is that I've not read about what the story is exactly because it hasn't been translated from Romanian into English. That's what's written here. So I'm like, okay, well, we're all looking forward to finding out what's going on there. But ultimately, right, that's all just, you know, noise. The biggest spoiler about this is that we find out where that other location went, right, and what it linked back to. It just so happened that when you went through the projection room and through the tunnel that leads to Egypt, you come out into this facility which had been adapted for human use.
Oh.
It had anti-gravity gliding devices that were there, but also remember that weird chamber that I described that was in the center of the room? The one that was adapted for human use in Egypt allows people to review the Akashic records.
Amazing. So obviously having all this technology explains why Romania is the world's superpower that it is today.
Let me also read for you, and this is what I will leave you with because this is what I was left with, a lot of observations and not many answers. Now that you have completed this book, I sincerely invite you to read it again and again.
No.
There is much wisdom herein that you cannot help but gloss over with one or two readings.
No.
That's how I felt.
I don't want to read it again. I don't even want to listen to it again.
And by the time, it was like 8 o'clock here, and I was like, I've got to record. I can't read it yet again. So I will leave it in the show notes for you to check it out. Look, it's...
I'm glad you read that.
Yeah, I'm glad.
Instead of me.
It's a cool story. I will give you that. I must say, there's a lot of elements in that I go, look, when you've got a whole heap of aliases, you know, you've got a lot of convenient kind of stories coming up, it makes me go, is this just some, you know, Romanian... folktale that's being kind of converted into this story, or is there more to it?
It's funny how much of it lines up with what I've got coming up in Plus, considering my story actually happened.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well,
and
that's
a real event with real people and real places.
I'm glad we managed to make it work out that way. That sounds pretty good.
So after the break, I'm going to be talking about the story of Tulshuk Lingpa, this Tibetan monk who received spiritual revelations about the entrance to a hidden realm in a crack in the sides of Mount Kanchenjunga. In the kingdom of Sikkim. Tibetan tradition had long spoken about its existence and the magical properties of the secret land within. So the legends told that when you entered this forbidden valley, this hidden valley, aging would stop. There's stories of people stumbling in there and then walking out and 100 years have passed. Time flows differently. You'll never get cold. You'll never get hot. It's this weird utopia where the rules of physics and the universe are completely different. This heavenly land hidden inside the Himalayas. And in the autumn of 1962, this man led his followers to find it. on an incredibly dangerous expedition. Like, picture 90-year-old grannies having sold everything they own. Like, these people sold their homes, they sold all their possessions, all they traveled with this guy was the clothes on their back and some food supplies. Imagine old ladies scaling the ice with ice picks in the Himalayas to find this hidden valley.
Surely that would be quite dangerous.
Oh, yeah. It's incredibly dangerous. And it all happened. That's coming up after the break in our Plus extension. We're going to be talking about A Step Away from Paradise, the true story of a Tibetan Lama's journey to a land of immortality. If you want to get access to that, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. Sign up today and you get access to the big extensions we do on these shows every single week. And you also get entirely exclusive shows we put out on Tuesdays as well. You're getting more than double the content when you sign up for Plus. You also get a higher bitrate feed. You get a higher quality MP3 we put out exclusive to Plus members, a totally ad-free version of the show as well. And if you sign up for our MU Max tier, you get access to our entire back catalogue. It's all available there on our website. Check it out, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. $9 a month. Help support your favourite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Stick around for the great stuff after the break if you're on Plus. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week.
Plus extension, great to have you with us.